In the studio this morning, I have Warwick Davies. Warwick has spent 20 years developing a world-leading technology to eliminate waste, turning it into a valuable resource for manufacturing many different products. But more important, it recovers the energy from the waste. This system is a global first and is so necessary for today, as one of the greatest attributes of the system is that it reduces CO2 and methane to the atmosphere from landfills, which is increasingly having an adverse effect on our atmospheric environment. So I want to say kia ora and good morning, Warwick.
Good morning, Tim, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to my fellow New Zealanders today. I would strongly advocate all that Tim has said, and one has to know that even with our extraordinarily good sewage treatment nowadays, it's much better than the Egyptians had or the Mexicans utilize right now on their coast, and I was recently on their coast, and their pristine beaches are covered with sewage. It's a shame. But in New Zealand, we are putting all of our nutrient-rich treated sewage effluent, not just nutrients, enriched with heavy metals and dioxin, and we're pumping that out onto our windward coast in most instances, and it rolls back onto our beaches and into our mangrove swamps, where we breed all our fish, and with a country that uses its fishing resource to make a great deal of money, it really spells the end of it or the demise of it. I recently spent some time at the South Pole, just south of the Falkland Islands, on a drilling rig. The drilling rig went from New Zealand's Marlborough Sound to Terra de Fuego, where it was then used to drill oil for the Total Oil Company. The interest to me was that when I first landed in Terra de Fuego, in the airport was a notice saying, while you are here, don't eat any of the shellfish. We've had a bloom, had bad contamination of our shellfish. It had just come from New Zealand, where we had the same thing going on. I wonder whether that infestation wasn't propagated by the mussels that were all over the legs of our drilling rig that came from our Marlborough Sounds. And so you have to say that man's waste practices have ramifications and serious problems that can emerge from just many things that we in our daily lives wouldn't dream of happening. So it has been the work of my group of scientists and engineers to develop a way to handle waste so it no longer is waste but is a valuable resource. And in order to do that, it has to be an integrated process where the waste heat and the waste products of one industry become the energy and the raw material for another. And that's called closing the waste stream loop. And we have successfully done that in our olivine technology so that at this stage we no longer have any waste at all that goes to a landfill or goes off the site.
So can you explain each particular system, Warwick?
Well, it's an industrial park. It has an asphalt plant, and unlike all other asphalt plants around the world, it has no smell. And it doesn't use any fossil fuel energy apart from the waste oil that we recycle that just trims the temperatures. It rather uses the waste heat from our various processes to heat the aggregate and to heat the oil, which then heats the bitumen to make the asphalt. And then the fumes from the batching plant, which are prevalent around the world, are then taken back to our combustors where we combust those exhaust gases, and that gets rid of all of the organic gases that make the smell from an asphalt plant, unburned hydrocarbons. So we tidy up an asphalt plant, we get rid of the aggregate from our combustors, which are an advanced gasification process, and that advanced gasification process is the heart of our technology. But unlike other waste-to-energy plants around the world, we are taking our byproducts, which are the fly ash that have the heavy metals and the nasties in them, and those go straight to our vitrifiers, which turn those heavy metals into glass. We take all the chemicals and all of the nasties from our dangerous goods in the country, which currently go to France at great expense to the New Zealand ratepayer, and that is used in a waste-to-energy plant in France, and it's not a very good one either, and it's hardly the thing that we should responsibly do. What are we doing here in New Zealand and all around the world today? We're doing the same things as the Egyptians did, as Tim talked about, thousands of years ago. We haven't got the wit to do anything but to bequeath to our children and future generations a filthy mess from our landfills, where we've wasted all the resource, wasted the energy, which is the biggest concern, and we are continually raping our planet for more resources while we tip the resources that we don't need into our landfills. And we look at our industries around the world, and they are making refrigerators that when I was a boy lasted for 30 years, and you'd be lucky if you can get them to last for 30 months today. So we have designed obsolescence by all our industries. So we're wasting our energy, we're wasting our resources when we do that, and it's completely unnecessary. And that has to be stopped. We also have to stop landfilling. The landfilling is doing a massive pollution job on our groundwaters and our river waters. In New Zealand, we have three landfills right alongside the Waikato River. There is one in Narrawahia that has some big pipes. You might have noticed them as you drive by on the highway. And they pipes are surrounded by concrete up to 8 to 10 feet. That concrete's to stop the kids from cutting the plastic pipes off and sniffing the fumes from the landfill below, which is like sniffing glue, but it destroys their lungs and their brains. And you got to say that it's right alongside the Waikato River, which floods every year, and the leachate from that landfill is still pouring into our river. The Perry Tip out of Hamilton gets flooded every now and then. What happens to the leachate from that tip? It's not just going to sit there. And the leachate recovery system is just absolutely ineffective. And it's into the river it goes, along with the waste from Horatu Freezing Works. I've certainly been through some treatment processes, but still, once again, spiked with nutrients, and those nutrients cause shellfish blooms and destroy shellfish on the west coast of New Zealand. There's no reason for doing that. There are better ways to do it. Is it because people are making so much money, like pigs at the trough, out of our waste, that they don't want to do something useful with it? There's a time for change, and the time is now, because we're seeing massive stress on our planet. The CO2 that comes from our landfills and the methane, and in fact, these figures come from consultants that work for landfill lobbies, and they have claimed as high as 500 cubic metres at some of the hearings, the Mount Wellington hearing specifically, per tonne of garbage, to 200, which is around the world the accepted figure, 200 cubic metres of landfill gas a year. That landfill gas is 48% carbon dioxide approximately, 48% methane, and the other 4% is hydrogen sulfide, mercaptans, all of the nasty gases that you can possibly imagine. And they are carcinogenic, many of them, deadly toxic gases. And they go to atmosphere. And if you look at the garbage we're producing in New Zealand today, that garbage represents 800 million cubic metres of landfill gas a year. If you had that amount of methane and you used it productively, you would get around 800 megawatts of power. That's what we would produce from New Zealand's garbage. 800 megawatts of power an hour. And 68% of that, augmenting our waste with the waste from our forestry and farming industries, could produce that amount of power in New Zealand. 68% being from biomass and the balance from fossil fuel. So there's not a great deal of fossil fuel in our waste. If you look at the Auckland studies of waste done by the Regional Council in the 1990s, you would see that 8% is plastic. We want that plastic. We use it in our industries. We want the tyres. We use that as an upward modulator for energy, but primarily we want the steel back from the tyres, and we get the steel back in our process, and it goes to our own foundry. We want the sulphur from our waste. That sulphur, 4,000 tonnes from one of our plants, is an excellent fertiliser. It's a source of fertiliser, and it's also used because it is a particle sulphur used extensively in our spray industry to control fungus and things like that in our plants. So we have a use for the sulphur. The hydrochloric acid we recover at 34%, and that has extensive use in industry. Currently is made from processes that use tar. So is our colloidal sulphur. But in our process, it's a byproduct. If we also make glass, and the glass that we make, virgin glass, we make valuable glass products. And that comes from the nasties in the waste, the things that we don't put in our combustor that go through the vitrifiers that have no emissions to air. Our vitrifiers have five different industries related to them: the hydrochloric acid, the sulfur, the glass making, and we recover 2 tonnes of mercury. Where does that go if you put it in the landfill? And we also are recovering hydrogen and CO, which run 6 Zimbarka ship engines, and then the exhaust gases from those are put through reheaters, and that way we increase the efficiency of their generation. And the exhaust gas from that goes to our combustors, and we get the waste heat back in our combustors. So we are the most efficient energy producer of any biomass plant in the world today, because we are recovering the heat from our ash. We're recovering all those waste heats from the industries I've just covered. And we're also making asphalt, and we're making concrete block, and we're using carbon dioxide sequestration process to cure our concrete. This is becoming a very exciting and new and extensive field, and we are standing on the edge of being able to make concrete, or a concrete material, without cement. And that has a massive end result, and saving of carbon dioxide in the order of 1 billion tonnes a year around the world. And that's exciting. We are currently, instead of making that 48% CO2 that I told you about, that is going up in our landfill gas to atmosphere in New Zealand every year, and it's making no energy, nor is the methane making any energy, and it should be. And so that CO2 we didn't need to make, and methane that we didn't need to make. Instead of abusing the farmers for growing the food that we all need, why don't we get ahead and see if we can't stop the methane production that comes from the landfills of the world? And in the United States, that amounts to 46% of the methane produced in the United States. It doesn't need to happen. And nor does the CO2 need to go to atmosphere, and certainly we don't want the 4% of nasty gases that are going to atmosphere, inclusive of the hydrogen sulfide and the mercaptans and all of those other poisonous gases going to atmosphere. The dioxin myth. I don't say it's a myth in terms of the fact that we don't want it in our food stream and we don't want it in our air. But you've got to remember that the dioxin coming from the toilet paper in our sewage sludge and from our waste leaves waste from the Manawatu tip, done in studies by Massey University, with 18 nanograms of dioxin TEQ per litre of landfill leachate. And that's way, way beyond Dutch health standards, the WHO standards, the World Health Organization standards. So we can do better than that. We are a dioxin sink. We destroy it. We make 0.2 of a gram from 1.8 million tonnes of waste a year, for our plant. That is a massive dioxin sink. So if you want to get rid of the dioxin in our country, you want to reduce the dioxin inventory in this country, get rid of the recycling of the cellulose in the paper instead of the energy. Paper is a biomass fuel. On the one hand, we have our government out and organizations all around the Western world saying that we should be burning grown energy to stop fossil fuel use. I certainly agree. Well, what about paper? If you make a ton of paper, and with the modern paper mill being as efficient as it is, making a third of its energy from the liquor that comes from the wood, from the tree, and the other two-thirds of the energy coming from the grid. If we, in our process, where we are now getting 900 kilowatts per ton of waste, and that's the equivalent of 1.5 barrels of oil. And in fact, in the higher, drier areas, it gets up to 1.8 barrels of oil per ton of garbage. So if you can mitigate using that, you stop carbon from fossil fuel. What is carbon from fossil fuel? It's carbon that come from the diatoms in our oceans, mostly, and in our water streams. Waikato River has got its own freshwater diatoms. And that's what made the coal that the Waikato left behind it when it flowed out in the Hauraki Plains, and that's Kaupuka Mines. Open cast mines now, where you can see the mine deposit of coal looks just like the river winding its way across the countryside. So our coal and our oil comes from those diatoms. The biggest animals in our world live on those diatoms. The 80% of the carbon dioxide absorbed by our plant life in the world and turned back into oxygen comes from, 80% of it is handled by the diatoms.
Can you describe the diatoms more clearly?
They are plankton. They are basically elementary plant and animal life, mostly plant. And when they die, they settle to the bottom of the ocean, they get sedimented over, and that's our oil field. And what are we trying to do? We're trying to get rid of millions of years of carbon dioxide deposited in a bank in the forms of our diatoms that makes our oil fields and our coal. And we're going to get rid of it in 300 or 400 years with the absolute greed of man and with no concern for the planet that supports us. The global warming that will inevitably bite our tails, but much more than concern to me than the global warming, because man will get its comeuppance when the ocean does rise, when you float off the ice at the southern hemisphere, off the ice shelf to the south. You'll get a tidal wave, as has happened before, across the top end of New Zealand, and that's what flattened the Waihara forest 12,500 years ago, and I have a table made from that timber. And I've had it carbon dated to ascertain how long ago that happened. And there was no bushworm in the tree at all. All the trees, the whole forest lying in the same direction to the northwest.
And kauri trees.
Big kauri trees, 22 feet in diameter. And there are three forests deep there. So it's happened plenty of times before. But now man is going to do it with a process that doesn't have a check and a control. The check and the control in the past was that the volcanoes of the world put up all the dust into our Van Allen belt, or the magnetic field of the earth, which is what makes our sky blue. And as a scientist at the pole, I was studying in the 60s with all sky cameras measuring the blueness or intensity of the blue in our sky, and then relating that to the dust loading. So if you have a Mount St. Helens, a Mount Pinatubos, a Mount McMurray that have exploded in the last 15 to 18 years, they have inevitably postponed or countered some of man's effect on global warming. They are the filters that allow us to... That dust in the Van Allen belt allows us to live on the planet. We wouldn't be able to take the bombardment of long-length UV light from the sun without that filter. And isn't it interesting that that filter at the South Pole or the North Pole in the summertime doesn't prevail because our magnetic field comes in at the poles, doesn't hold any dust. And so the oxygen at the poles in the summer gets bombarded by UV light and it makes an awful lot of ozone. So the most ozone in the world exists at the poles in the summertime and at the end of summer. But because ozone is radioactive oxygen, and it hardly does you any good in life, it's made from our welding, and it's made by lightning storms, and it's made by flashing or arcing electricity in the atmosphere. And so it is an indicator of how functional the Van Allen belt, or the magnetic field of the Earth and the magnetic field dust filter, is working. And at the South Pole and the North Pole, at the end of the winter, there is no ozone. There's always been a hole, an ozone hole. And that hole is the result of the fact that ozone, made by three oxygen molecules making two O3s, has a half-life of 3 or 4 days in the atmosphere, and by the end of the summer has all gone. And it's not until the sun rises again at the poles and starts to bombard the oxygen layer and gets high enough to do that, that you start to make the UV light. I was intensively involved in monitoring the ozone in the 60s over the whole North Pole region.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, please, Warwick?
Yeah, we were 13 scientists on an ice island at the pole, and we were very close to the pole at one stage in that period that I was on the ice island. There were 13 scientists, three Eskimos, and a mechanic. When I was there, the station was started by the Air Force in 1953. In 1953, the Air Force left a lot of equipment up there. In 1965 and 66, I started some of that equipment for the first time. There was even a set of harrows up there for rebuilding the runway at the end of the summer. A road grader, a real old one, Caterpillar, that I had to start with a pony engine, and because I was a Kiwi, I knew how to do that, and the scientists didn't. But I established a program for the University of Washington and a physical oceanography we were involved in, and I did the navigation for a period at the pole on the island, which was very difficult to do in those days, and I was a pilot, so I flew extensively with Harvey Wheeler and Bob Murphy and Fisher, I should mention, who later died there, and they were some of the world's leading outback ice flying pilots. We landed on skis. We had to land every 8 hours, and we'd sometimes go for 16 hours from the ice island with a whole stack of 4-gallon cans packed into the back of the airplane full of fuel. We had to land to refuel, and we used to look for a lead that was fractured, because over the lead, you could always find that lead because it was a big black cloud. And the black cloud was because the pole, the North Pole, and the South have very, very dry air because it's cold. And our humidity got down to as low as 0.003% of humidity dry ball. And it was that cloud that formed, or the evaporation from the sea because of the cold, dry air in the summertime, that led us to the lead, and then we'd find that the ice was in traction there rather than compression, so there would be further leads that had broken free a week or two before, and they would have frozen over. And so we would bounce the skis on the lead, on one of the older leads, see if the ice supported us, go around in a circle, have a look at it, and see if there were no cracks. We landed. We'd drill a hole, drop a depth charge, a small depth charge, which we were using to calibrate the Demis that was also developed on Ice Island T3 at that time. But we were doing gravity stations and measuring ozone, and we had wheatgrass spores in our microscope, and we'd count the spores' proliferation and then index it to the ozone content of the air at that time. So we were able to get spore proliferation counts with virtually zero ozone in the atmosphere, which we have at the pole at the end of the winter, or by the end of the summer, a massive ozone, so it gave a very good controlled experiment. I could have told them from my physics at New Plymouth Boys High in 1956 and 57, that it was the fixation of nitrogen that was causing their wheat rust, but the University of Nebraska did the world a favour because they indexed the ozone all over the pole at that time. So, you know, there are reasons for our survival on the planet. We are already far too many people living on this planet. And I'm sure that's going to get fixed quite readily by the Lord very quickly. But I think that we could support those people if we exercise good science and pragmatism rather than influence science by corruption and the intrinsic interests of a few at the expense of the balance of the population. We have enough food to feed the whole planet, but we just don't distribute it. It's human greed continually that becomes the problem of the human race.
I'm speaking with Warwick Davies. He's here in the studio with me today. Warwick has been involved for a long time in looking at the ice shelf, particularly in the Arctic up north Canada. And from that, he has concluded, because the ice has melted where he previously was, that global warming definitely is an occurrence, and that we humans have to be aware of the fact that we're putting out far too much CO2 into the atmosphere, which is obviously heating the planet up.
Not just CO2, Tim, CO2 and methane. And we don't need to unless we make energy with it. But I'm much more concerned about the acidification of our oceans from the CO2, because it's that that's destroying our coral and our marine life. And I think what everyone in our Western world should know about this global warming thing is that it's not a warming of the outside air temperature that is necessarily going to happen. It's moving and changing our ocean currents. And a warm water current hitting the North Pole right now, where 44% of the ice 3 years ago was gone. University of Washington's been monitoring it since I left there in 1956. And we've had nearly three times the CO2 concentration in our atmosphere that we had at that time. That's alarming. The acidification of the oceans, however, and those ocean currents are able to move the Gulf Stream south, which makes Northern Europe a very frigid place to be. As I told you about those leads at the pole, I had an intent to finish that story, and that is that when you take the ice away at the pole between July and September, they're saying this year there'll be virtually none left. And if that happens, you turn one of the driest regions in the world into the most humid. So you're going to see snowfalls in Siberia and Northern Europe that are absolutely massive. But snow doesn't fall at 50 below zero. It falls at 4 below zero. So it's still a warmer world, but with very icy sort of environment that one's left with. You change the climate in Northern Europe and their food supply dries up. There are massive consequences of it. The same thing will happen in New Zealand. New Zealand may not get warmer, it may get colder. And the colder because we're going to have all that ice, and it's happening right now, melting off the ice shelf, the Ross Ice Shelf and out of Georgia Sound, and that current comes up our coast. Hence a couple of icebergs floating up the coast a couple of years ago. That's not funny. It's darned alarming. Those four ice islands that were occupied out there, plus one that wasn't occupied, were carved off Ellesmere Island 2,000 years ago or more. They've all gone since 1966. The whole lot have gone. Down the Greenland coast and out to sea. Greenland today and Thule as I saw it in 1966 are two different places. It's frightening. What we're seeing there is ice screaming down the Atlantic conveyor, and I've flown over it the last 3 years in a row, every November, end of November, still pouring down that coast. And it didn't happen before. We had 20 days at 20 below zero before an airplane would land on T3 at the end of the summer. And we were getting that by the 20th of September. So now we're going to see a lot of snow early in the winter, a lot of humidity in the north, the mists of Atlanta returning.
It happened before, it's happened, and it will raise the oceans, and the oceans will raise slowly for a while. But when you melt off that ice, that Ross ice shelf, it'll displace its own weight in water. And they've got a tidal wave. That's what took out that Cowrie Forest at Waiharara. And that tidal wave covered it with seawater because the bush borer didn't get at it. And there's no bush borer except a little bit in the top of the log where I got my table from. And that bit of bush borer was a result of draining the swamp at Waiharara, and they got in there then. The bark was still on the tree. The gum had turned to jelly. And by the time I dried it, it re-solidified. But that is a story on its own. What I'm telling you is that this all relates, and that the changing of our climate is going to have massive effects on the human race. It's not necessarily warming, and atmospherically, in some places it will get much hotter and drier, and other places it will get much colder and wetter. So, beware, be ready, and if you don't want to do anything, if it's just the 3-year election term that we're worried about for our politicians and local body politicians, the planet's doomed. We better get moving and do something before it happens. I think it's too late anyhow. I think it's too late then.
The story is the human spirit never gives up. And see, this is what you're doing with your globalolivine.com, your profound industrial park. To be able to pull all the components together from a standpoint, if you have waste paper, you have waste glass, you have waste aluminium, and you have all these particular products going into this industrial park, you're going to turn that round, and at the other end, you're going to have aluminium ingots.
Yeah. I didn't finish the little paper story, and I'd like to finish that. That I showed you how, from a tree, we got all the energy to make a ton of paper from the tree. But if you recycle the cellulose in the paper instead of the energy, you will use 1.4 megawatts instead of 1.8 per ton of energy. And that whole 1.4 megawatts has to be assumed to come from fossil fuel, the worst form of generation on our grid. And the next thing that happens is that the paper manufacturer, who's got an $800 million asset, it gets you bringing back the cellulose to them, which is a biomass fuel. There's no global warming effect as a biomass fuel. And you're taking that back to him, and he doesn't plant another forest to sequester some more carbon dioxide out of the air, because he doesn't need to. You took him back the cellulose. And the whole 1.4 megawatts comes from fossil fuel. So the worst thing you can do for the environment is recycle the cellulose and paper instead of the energy. The energy is a biomass green energy fuel.
But the most important thing is to be able to get people to get involved. We need to be able to have a vision of tomorrow as how we can actually put something in place. And this is where, again, I go back to your industrial park, where everything goes in and everything is sorted and utilized and put into a product that can be used again.
That's exactly what I have said for years, Tim. That stint at the pole told me what was happening at that early stage to our planet. And it was for that reason that I've got involved in this. And we have a charitable trust that owns our industry. And we've had to set that offshore so that we could do all this research without being taxed while we did it. And it's my contention that the waste conferences held by the bureaucrats of the world that go on around the world every year at enormous expense to the ratepayers of our Western world, and they all identify the waste problem, but none of them have an answer. I defy Greenpeace to come up with something constructive instead of just making a loud noise. It's not good enough to just sit around and whinge, as we call it in New Zealand and Australia. You have to get out and do something about it. And no one has the right to criticize, as I am right now, unless you're prepared to put something better in its place. And that's what I will leave you with today, Tim.
So how many landfills are there in New Zealand at the moment?
There's 106 in the Waikato District Council. And so, you know, that's old and new. We have the Barry's Point Road one that's still providing gas problems to the Cannon building over the road. And there are big signs all over the Cannon building in the basement because the gas has been coming up through the pipes around in the urinals. And anyone throwing a cigarette in there can catch a thing on fire. So that gas comes out of there. So we go in there and we suck the gas off the landfill. If you do that, you get an ingestion of oxygen, and then you can get spontaneous combustion. It catches on fire, and then you put liquid nitrogen in there to get rid of it. Smoky Mountain in the Philippines killed hundreds of people that were living on the tip, scavenging on the garbage. We have those that say, send our dangerous goods, our wee products. We handle all the wee products and recycle every bit of it. And there are no nasties coming from whiteware, electronics, and electrical equipment. That's what WE stands for. Right now, we're sending that stuff to Asia, and there are little kids that are trying to recycle parts out of it. Our process is thorough. We get the steel back. We get the aluminium out. We get even the gold and silver from the circuit cards is recovered in our vitrifiers in a melt, and that melt can be taken away and separate those valuable metals. So every aspect of the garbage we recover. And the only thing that we lose by weight is the moisture that goes up the chimney, steam, and the carbon dioxide, which we get from the oxidization of carbon, which makes energy. But we are 2.5 times more efficient in terms of carbon dioxide to atmosphere for megawatts produced than a coal-fired power station, and we are the same as a gas-fired power station, except that all of our fuel is from waste, number one, and that waste represents about 68% of non-fossil, or other words, green energy, and it's only the balance. And if we can reduce that by front-end recycling and get the plastics back, we have a plastic factory that makes pallets for all the products that go out of our plant, and we make plastic pallets from it. We have a water bottling plant where we use the PET that we recover along with some more virgin plastic for making water bottles. But we make all the containers out of HDPE recycled and the mixed plastics, as I said, into the pallets. The HDPE holds our acid and our sulfur and other things that go to the market. So we make our own containers on site, and we will have surplus capacity from those plants. Our foundry turns out 68,000 tons of metal a year. It's very high quality metal. And the waste heat from the cooling of the metal goes back into our Rankine cycle, which increases our efficiency on the plant. And we use water as a battery storage, our feed water, and we keep 4,000 tons of that, so we can use that to modulate our power supply at peak times. Non-peak times, when we back off a bit, we take that heat that we recover and heat our feed water for the peak times. So the whole plant is one of looking at recovery of all the waste heats and waste energies. It's one of taking and making productive things out of everything that's represented in your waste. Even drums of cement-stabilized chemicals we can put through, crush up, and put through our vitrifiers and turn into glass and recover the metals. So you took copper, chrome, arsenic into our vitrifiers. We get the copper and the chrome back in the metal under the glass, and the arsenic becomes a flux in the glass. So we have complete stabilization. What do we do here in New Zealand? We label all the containers, and then we send them down to a depot in East Tamaki. And they've got nothing to do with methyl ethyl ketone and those things. They put them in a pond, dump topsoil in there with it, mix it up with a digger. And when they get it thick, like thick porridge, take it over to the tip and put it in the tip. And that's called stabilization of our dangerous goods. What nonsense. Come on, we can do better than that. That's absolute nonsense. And we take that and we make valuable fuel out of it, glass out of it, whatever. We get the metals back out of it. And so there is complete recycling. We've heard enough from people whinging and complaining about the waste thing. Let's do something. make your politicians do something. Their three-year tenures demand that we find a new way to handle waste. It's expensive up front, but they're going to make an awful lot of money. And in fact, your waste tipping fees will drop from the $68 to $100 that it's costing a ton right now. We could do it for your $40 New Zealand at the moment. And we get all that energy back. Our byproduct industries are run at night so that we run at our non-peak times, use 400,000 megawatt hours of power a year in our byproduct industries. But we're exporting 1,100,000 megawatt hours of power to other industry around us. We can take your sewage sludge and we turn it into glass and we get the heavy metals back out of it and destroy the dioxin in it. We take the tyres, all of the chemicals. There are no waste. The electric light bulbs and the fluorescent light bulbs go into our wee producing process and get all the nasties and turned into glass, and anything that we can recover is recovered by way of metal or by way of chemicals. So there's no reason to throw this product away. It's not waste. It's a valuable resource. It's not something that we should be sending off to a landfill to make a pigsty out of our environment, to use our oceans, our atmosphere, and our groundwater as a dump because we don't have the wit to do something better. It's not on. It's time we stopped. Why don't you all demand it of your politicians and your local body governments? Because the local body governments are just some of the pigs at the top. They are making the money out of the landfills. They own the landfills. They monitor the landfills. The consultants that support them are making a fortune out of it as well. And it's all at your expense and our environment's expense.
Your industrial park, Warwick, covers what, 3 to 4 hectares?
No, it's much bigger than that, Dermot. If we're making water, we make up to 116,000 tonnes of water a day from MED. Multiple effect desalination of seawater. Some years ago I built the Orewa Reservoir, and the water for Orewa and Waiwera is from the fault line. It's groundwater and it's geothermal water. So it needed to cool in the reservoir. So it was a big reservoir, 12,500 tonnes of water. We're making nearly 10 of those a day, reservoirs full of water from a plant. What we do is use a ship, and we're offshore working on a plant now, where we will have 3 ships, and we have no trucks at all. So our transfer stations are hooked up to docks, and they come into our plant. We'll make them 116,000 tons of water a day, and we haul all the waste in and haul the byproducts back and sell them at our transfer stations. What people forget, you go for a resource consent, they'll say, well, let's have a look at your traffic plan. Well, if it's a one-way trip to the tip, you're going to have, say, 500 trucks. And if you're going to bring this up, if you get all these byproducts made, it's 700 trucks a day. We don't see that as being sustainable. So with using ships and containerization and specially designed ships for the job, they can run around a city like Auckland and pick up waste from Coromandel, Thames, all over the Hauraki Gulf and right up to North Harbour, all over the city, Kay Road, a transfer station, and from the city, East Tamaki, up to a plant that should be situated just south of Whangaparoa. Because Whangaparoa, and there's plenty of land there for it, was seafront. And Whangaparoa is a place that is a dormitory city. Massive traffic problems, getting people in and out of there to work. We set the industries there so that they've got jobs right handy. And we've got a place to produce the water they don't have, clean water. And we have the ability to take their sewage effluent and their sewage sludge and to dispose of it in a right and proper way. And that is what we need, and we need also to be able to support the grid north of the bridge. And everyone knows about that, And the megavars that our plant produced, because we're in minus one, and it's the most reliable power in the world. We have 12 boilers, 4 turbines, and 6 ship engines, all generating power. So if we shut one of those things down for we just wind up the rest, and we have are able to contractually take care of all the waste we contract to take care of, and to produce the power we contractually support or claim to be able to produce. And that excess generation capacity we have turns out megavars, or grid support, for the grid in North Auckland, and it badly needs it. So that is the sort of thing you do with the region's garbage. Strategically find the right place to build the plant for first.
And you've had a pilot scheme happening, certain aspects of this?
Yeah, we're doing it offshore right now, but we think that Auckland and the greater Auckland region have better do something about their waste. They're making a filthy mess, and they need to sort it. And we have the potential to do it. But I guess a profit at home is like no profit at all. Is that what they say, Tim? I don't know. But, you know, we've had one go here. It cost us $3 million of development money. And next time we'll be doing it, and the government can own the plant. And let the government do the job, because they've made it so impossible for anyone else to do anything that's constructive in New Zealand, with a Resource Management Act that's completely confrontational, does nothing for the environment, and only lines the pockets of the lawyers that live on the confrontation.
So we've got a challenge here. Not only have we need to put our waste into a situation where it's dealt with appropriately, but we've got huge bureaucratic challenges around vested interests.
Vested interests. The pigs at the trough making a fortune, a few of them, out of our waste stream, which is your valuable resource, you, the New Zealander. We've got a power problem in New Zealand. That's shocking. If we have a change of climate and we're completely reliant on hydro water, and we've subsidised those power stations and resold what was the property of the New Zealand taxpayer, he'd paid for them once already. We're now paying for them again. The 10 cents on the dollar of a Clyde Dam, it was sold for. So how do you compete with that with a new power station? No wonder no one wants to build a new power station in New Zealand. And we don't have the gas for it anyhow. So if you build it with gas, you'll run out of gas. And so then up goes the power price, and then we're going to bring cryogenic gas from the Australian shelf. That's not supportable. You've got your tips that can produce 800 megawatts right now. 4 plants in New Zealand would take care of all of New Zealand's waste. And you put them where you strategically need grid support and where the power is most valuable. And you start using our water in our ports to haul it, because a ship is so much more effective environmentally in terms of carbon credit or carbon footprint than the trucking industry or a rail that's absolutely defunct and useless. So, and it's not really that green anyhow. You're still using, for 1,250 tons of carriages and waste, still using a very, very big engine. One 1,500 to 2,000 horsepower. So basically, ships are the way to move waste. And waste is lighter than water. Compacted in containers, as ours is, it's odourless in its transportation state. And we're actually offshore going to use it for a ferry for people on deck, because the ships are doing a daily service, and 2 ships could provide a whole plant here, but a third needs to back up, and that could back up 4 plants in New Zealand.
So it's www.globalolivine.com.
Globalolivine.com.
And so if anybody wants to go up, all the listeners want to look at that website, then you'll get the understanding of how, under one roof or one umbrella, all waste items can be utilised again or transmuted into another material.
Well, you never get rid of material in this world. It's only energy that's causing the problem on the planet. And it's the energy efficiency as well that's thinking important.
Warwick, thank you very much for coming in and really telling us what we need to do here.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Tom.